And hello, we welcome you to Lunch Talk Live, our final edition for the pandemic here. Mike Tirico, glad you have joined us today and have joined us the last 10 weeks. If we've done this show at noon Eastern on NBCSN throughout, we'll be thanking folks along the way for making it possible. But if you want to go relive any of the over 200 interviews that we've done here on the show, they are available to you on the podcast, which is aptly named the Mike Tirico Podcast, one of our more creative moments, or you can go watch the show on our NBC Sports YouTube channel, all archived there. And a great wrap-up guest list coming up here. Mike Milbury in a minute, Matt Vasgersian, who I think has turned into the commissioner of Major League Baseball. We'll ask Matt what he was up to last night as well. Jimbo Fisher, the coach at Texas A&M, Paul Azinger, Martin Truex, who won the NASCAR race last week, and Nick Luck, our racing analyst. We have a busy week of live horse racing coming up on the networks next week. That's one of the reasons that our show is ending, because live sports is starting once again more and more. We saw it with the golf yesterday. You'll see it with a lot of horse racing coming up next week, leading to the Belmont Stakes a week from tomorrow. All right, let's bring in our first guest, and it will be Mike Milbury joining us, our NHL analyst. Of course, Mike, well, what can you say about Mike now that he's on Twitter? Really, he showed up announcing himself to the world of social media, shoe in hand, haircut that hopefully has grown out since that picture was taken and ready to roll. So, Mike, first off, let's start with the Twitter world. How's that going for you?
It's going okay. We talk about it, my son and I. It was his impetus to get me on it. And we'll raise certain topics. He prints it all out, types it out, and I just let it go. I don't look at any responses. I don't need any responses. And, you know, it's been fun. Been a moment or two every day where we talk about relevant topics and try to get something that people might be interested in, but you know, it's all his idea.
Good. Well, I can't wait to be with you during maybe the hockey playoffs or somewhere along the line where we start reading back the comments and let you interact with people. Then
yeah,
it could get really
happen,
spicy.
Mike. Not gonna happen.
Maybe we shouldn't do that. The haircut's worked out okay, though. Overall, you look pretty good here. Have you enjoyed the time to have a break here and relax and recharge for the rest of the season?
No, I don't like it at all. I'm dying to get back to work. I mean, I've done enough work in my garden. My basement's clean. My cellar's, my garage is clean. You know, I'm looking for things to do. And so I can't wait. The news is good. July 10th, perhaps we're getting back to it. And see the guys on the ice, and it's going to be interesting to see how everybody comes out of this break.
Yeah, let's get to the hockey in all seriousness and ask a couple of questions related to the calendar here. So we've got the dates, July 10th for the big training camp. The players are coming back with groups of six, no more than six right now. The Bruins, one of the teams at their facility, doing that. So, Mike, as a player, how would you feel about this stretch from now to July 10th? What would you be trying to do to get ready for when these training camps restart for the teams that are still going to be playing?
You've got to skate. That's simple. I assume that they were doing the best they could to stay in shape. But as you know, Mike, there's nothing like the act of skating. And I think a big factor in how this thing plays out down the end of the line here is how well these guys are trained and coached during this training camp period. It's going to be really critical to get them on their toes and moving quickly. And I'm not sure if it's going to have a bigger impact on the older guys who should be better because they've had a rest and then can recharge their batteries mm-hmm. for a shortened season. And you don't know if the young guys have the discipline and the sort of mandate to stay in shape as they go forward. So it's anybody's guess how the team shape out here. But I think it has a lot to do with training staff and coaches and how they prepare these guys as they hit the ice as a team.
Yeah, that was the other way I was going to go with you. Now, if you put the coaching hat back on, when you get them to this training camp starting July 10th, and you know you have 3 weeks or so to get them ready, not just to play, but to jump into an intense level, especially for those 5 through 12 teams in each conference, how do you go about trying to get them to that edge without pushing them too hard too early?
They've had a couple months off here. It's not like they're going to be tired. And if they have kept in shape, they're going to have to find a way to reestablish the pace of the actual games. That's not easy to do when there's six guys on the ice. But as they get closer to a full practice, they're going to have to do a lot of scrimmaging, a lot of high-tempo stuff to make sure that that as soon as this thing gets started, because it's elimination time for a lot of teams right off the bat, that they are at the top of their skating game. Now, that to me is of critical importance, and it always is. But you know, there's not going to be as much time for chit chat in the locker room and strategizing. And the first thing you got to do is you worry about conditioning, and you worry about getting their pace of play up to snuff.
You know, Mike, we've seen a bit of an evolution here in hockey. Four lines has always been significant, but teams playing that third and fourth line a significant amount in big spots as playoff series go on. How crucial will that depth be for teams once they start these, especially those best of five series?
Well, you're right about it. It used to be the third, fourth line got limited ice time. But now with the rule changes and the up-tempo game that everybody wants to play, you have to incorporate them. You have to have that kind of depth. You have to have that kind of trust in your fourth line. You know, here I'm in Boston, and the Bruins have four lines. Crowley's on the fourth line most of the time, and they have amazing faith in him to go up against the other team's top line. So it's of critical importance. And as you know, staying injury-free during this time is going to be important. And if you do get injured, you're going to lean even more on those guys at the bottom half of your roster.
One more question here, Mike, about the playoff structure. The teams 1 through 4 in each conference are going to be playing a round robin for seeding, as teams 5 through 12 are playing a best of five. Would you be really concerned about trying to get that top seed? How much would you put into that if you were coaching one of those top four seeded teams?
You're going to want to play to win, I think. It's been proven that home ice advantage is not as critical as it might be. I mean, St. Louis won on Boston's ice last year. So I think they need to get themselves in those three games to a point where they feel comfortable about the way their team is performing. Win, lose, or draw, they're going to have to try to play to win so that they're ready when they get to an elimination round.
And lastly, reseeding. So the teams that come over from that left column there will be all reseeded in addition with 1 through 4. There's been a lot of talk about that over the last few years, and it doesn't happen for a variety of reasons: scheduling, planning, geography. Do you like the fact that we'll be reseeding teams once we get into that first and second round?
Yeah, I like it. It's a little bit of a juggling act, and I think it adds a little spice to it. I think it's a good thing for the game, but, you know, who knows how that all works out? I guess we'll watch it play out as the season unfolds. But from my perspective, I think it adds a little spice to the affair.
All right. Well, we know you're chomping at the bit, ready to go. You're going to make it through this next month?
Yeah, I will. I'll get through it. You know, we got a place to work out upstairs and get myself in shape. And then we'll be ready to go sometime late July.
It's like a mini training camp for you. You can ramp up and be ready so you don't pull a muscle when we get on the set and all that stuff.
That's right.
We understand that with you and Catherine and Liam and Jonesy and the gang. So, hey, great to catch up with you, Mike. Thanks for hanging with us, and we'll hopefully see you soon.
All right. Thanks, Mike. See ya.
Twitter legend Mike Milbury joining us for a couple of minutes as we get ready for hockey. Let's transition to baseball. We still wait to find out if there's going to be a season, because hockey plans in place, basketball plans in place. So the draft was going on. And you pop on the TV last night, and all of a sudden, Matt Vasgersian was there playing the role of the commissioner of Major League Baseball, announcing all the picks as we went through rounds 2 through 5. You know Matt from MLB Network, Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN, MLB The Show. And Matt, how was it to play the role of commissioner?
Mike, it's something I think we've all dreamt of doing. And because it's such an important moment for these kids and for their families, you know, the only option you have is to play it straight. But there was the inner, you know, smart aleck in me that was saying, gosh, wouldn't it be great to slip in the name of one of my high school buddies in the fifth round by the Mariners and see if anybody catches on? You know, the Seattle Mariners with the 146th pick have selected now 52-year-old outfielder Mike Westmacott from Moraga, California. Yeah, Mikey, wee woo! You know, do one of those. But it was fun. It was kind of neat.
How did it all come about?
I am positive that the commissioner had prior engagements, given the state of the game. You know, I think all along he was scheduled just to be there for day one. And that's been the case historically for the MLB draft, dating back to Commissioner Selig when we first started having it at MLB Network in 2009. The commissioner's there for day one. You do the first round. And then the second round and subsequent rounds kind of take place in, I don't want to say anonymity, but without the kind of aplomb and fanfare that round one gets. And that's the case for any of the major sports drafts, I think. And again, not to take anything away from it, but I was happy to be there. You know, the unusual part of what happened last night, Mike, was that all these kids had their college and high school seasons truncated by the pandemic. And you're looking at the numbers. So somebody selects a kid out of a high school in Georgia in the third round, and then the numbers pop up on the screen and it says, you know, two starts, eight innings. And you're thinking, wow, there was so much more meat left on the bone for all these kids. And, you know, now we're in this scenario in baseball where there was a 5-round draft. Last year it was 40 rounds. Dating back years and years, it was 65 rounds. So what about those thousands of other players that might have had a shot at getting into a team system that are now home? As of Sunday, they can sign for $20,000, pretty reasonable price. If you're a high school kid and you have a chance to go to college, I think that college opportunity is probably more lucrative than taking a $20,000 flyer to go play short season A-ball maybe next year someplace. But if you're a college senior, and in the absence of a chance to go play overseas, you might consider that opportunity, and you might sign that $20,000 minor league free agent contract just to go show somebody you can play someplace. It's really a very unusual time that the game is in right now.
It is, and we talked about that for years and still do with the NFL draft, that once you finish the draft, which it was once 12, is now 7 rounds, those players get picked up right away to fill out 90-man rosters for teams. And sometimes the players, you can go someplace where your skill set may be most needed or a good fit. And perhaps we'll see that with the players who certainly would have been drafted in rounds 6 through 10 of the MLB draft. Can we spend a minute on minor league baseball? Because I've kind of hit it a few times with guests here and there. What are they trying to accomplish with a new-look minor league baseball system other than cutting costs?
Well, you know, I wish I could tell you, because the cost-cutting component is the one that just sticks out. And I get it. Look, you know, when you look at it from a business standpoint, Major League Baseball, and it's 30 clubs, it's 30 constituencies, if you will, fiefdoms almost, they're trying to be as lean as possible, as any business is, especially in these times. If college baseball can assume more of a role the way college football assumes a role with the NFL, serving as a feeder pipeline. Maybe that's part of it. No one said that to me, but beyond the obvious, the cost-cutting measures, and when you consider the 250-ish players in each team's minor league system, that's an immense amount of cost. From the other side of it, Mike, I came from minor league baseball. I spent 6 years as a minor league radio play-by-play guy. And I'd like to think that nobody has a bigger love or appreciation for that cottage industry than I do. I hate to see it go away. Maybe it sticks around and just looks different. That's my hope, that we just get through this transition and it's not impacted to the point that it goes away.
Yeah, perhaps some independent leagues grow, pick up. There are some interesting case studies out there. There's one in Michigan, for example, where three teams play a season from Memorial Day to Labor Day, all at the same field. And it's a constant presence there. You just rotate playing the other teams, and players can get seen that way. So somebody's going to have to be creative and find a new system and a way. Let's get back to the big league conversation in our last minute or so here, Matt. Do you think we're going to see baseball this year?
I do. I've been confident throughout this, and maybe I'm being a bit of a Pollyanna here, Mike, but I just think that there's way too much at stake on both sides for somebody not to make the kind of concession that's required to get the season in right now. The commissioner has at his disposal the the opportunity to implement a 50-game schedule. That's a last-case scenario. Right. Nobody wants to see this sport condensed to 50 games. It's not organic to the way this thing goes. And if you think about that, like the Washington Nationals, who started out, I believe, 19-31 last year in their first 50 games, they wouldn't have sniffed the postseason. So it's not a great litmus right. test. That's why they're both actively engaged in trying to make this happen. And look, the bigger fear I have, Mike, as opposed to this year, is what does it look like moving forward? Because with a new collective bargaining mm-hmm. agreement due in less than 2 years, one side might feel like they got their nose pushed too far out of place to get back onto the field this year. Right. And they'll begin a much bigger discussion, a much larger document shortly thereafter. And with one side angry, that's not a great way to begin that discussion. So I'm worried more long-term than I am for this year. I'm very, very confident they'll play this year.
Yeah, because the 2021 season's the last one under the current collective bargaining agreement. And then TV rights and all that stuff down the line all will kind of tie into what happens with Major League Baseball on the field. If we do play 50, and the longer we go, Matt, that's becoming more of the only option available. There are still others, but time's ticking here a little bit. If we play 50 and there's no expanded playoffs, do you think that will be seen forever as not just an asterisk, but as a significant asterisk on that season when we look back at baseball history?
It sure could. And the risk you run there is in a 50-game season, if certain players decide, look, I'm a year away from a walk season, or I'm entering a walk year,
right.
I don't want to play 50 games, make 8 starts, and not really have my act together and have that be on my permanent record as I go into free agency or arbitration or whatever financial mile marker is coming up next in the career of the player. Hmm. Same thing for a hitter. If you get 100 plate appearances in a short season, a lot of really good hitters have gone 10 for 100. It sounds hard to do,
right.
but it happens.
Right. Yeah.
And players are aware right. of that too. So I think that if there's a 50-game season, I would hope that it would come prior to an expanded playoff format, because that would kind of get the bad taste out of your mouth. If we get an NHL-style tournament with 16 teams competing, whatever the number might be, that to me is an exciting thing, and I'm holding out hope that that actually takes place.
And baseball might need to drum that up, because at that time of year, we're going to have basketball and hockey just wrapping up, football season kicking in gear. And if it's been a baseball season that some players may skip, fans may feel the same way about a postseason if it doesn't have some wrinkle to it. A lot to sort and do it quickly as well. Well, glad you got to at least put on a tie and clean up for one night and do a yeoman's job, a first-class job with all the names and playing commissioner for a night. So, Matt, thanks for the time. Look forward to hearing you back on TV and when our paths cross here somewhere on the road down the line.
You got it, Mike. Good to be with you.
Matt Vasgersian, MLB Network, ESPN Sunday Night Baseball, joining us there. Jimbo Fisher, head coach of Texas A&M. You know about the 12th man. Something interesting happened right at the 12th man statue on campus there in College Station. Jimbo will tell us about it after this. Well, the 12th man is such an integral part of Texas A&M football, and there's a 12th man statue near Kyle Field. Yesterday, about 350 or so student athletes, coaches, personnel were there. The idea of several African-American Aggie students. Coach Jimbo Fisher was one there as well, wearing a Black Unity t-shirt. And the players started and finished at that 12th man statue, and then some spoke. And Jimbo Fisher joins us now from College Station, Texas. How'd that all come about yesterday, Coach?
Well, in our athletic department, our student athletes had a group, and they wanted to not, we talked in football, do we want to have a walk, do we not? And they wanted to encompass all the student athletes from the university, not just the football, which I think was tremendous. And they put it together and did a really nice job with it. Very well organized and very good messages and of course, for a tremendous cause.
Of course, the conversation has been a lot about education, learning, listening. How much of that has been a part of the last couple of weeks with your team?
Tremendous amount. And even as a coach who have dealt with Black athletes, Black players for 30 years of coaching, you still, as you learn, because if they truly open up about all the different situations, and you've heard a lot of stories at different times over the years, but still, when they really get down to heart into different things that happened to their families, happened to them, I mean, it's an extremely educational process right now. And like I say, then we're trying to show support and also trying to help come up with ideas that can make significant change in the future.
Yeah, I mean, your time, whether it's LSU, Florida State, I mean, you've been national championship coordinator, national championship head coach in 2003 and 2013. You've been in a lot of living rooms. You've been with a lot of families. So you have seen a lot of the conversations that are going on firsthand. Even for you, have there been things that you've learned over the last couple of weeks that you hadn't heard expressed in this way before?
Most definitely, because as a coach, sometimes, you know, you hear all the stories and you see stories around your athletes that have to do with athletics. And you hear off and on of stories that happen away from when they're away from you out in society. But then I think it's just been the time and the movement that is going on right now is allowing kids to feel freer to really open up about everything, all the little details. So, I mean, there is so many things that just, you know, you say, wow. And, you know, and you're there to be supportive and always felt like we have been. But at the same time, it's an extremely educational process. And like you say, what you want to try to do is make sure that you can help create change, apply change, and make sure change is happening in the future.
Coach, I was interviewed by our colleagues, for me at least, at NBC News last night about a story regarding sports and the voices that we're hearing in sports. And as I was asked questions, I was able to share with them that, you know, we've had protests forever in sports. Go back to Jesse Owens, the Mexico City protests, obviously, Muhammad Ali. It feels like athletes are using social media to find their individual voices more now than ever before. You've recruited people for 20, 25 years, white and black. Do you see that this generation's athlete is using his and her voice to a different volume now?
See, I mean, tremendous. That's what I said. The way you recruit and the things you do now compared to not just 25 years ago, compared to even 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, the ability to communicate throughout our world and for people to get their stories and situations heard is totally different. And it does. It's a totally different person. It's a more, I'm not going to say individualistic person, but one who can, you know, express himself in so many different ways and so many avenues and has the outlets to be able to do that. So recruiting and communication has changed drastically.
Let's flip the conversation page here for a minute and discuss getting your football team back on campus a little bit. These voluntary workouts that the NCAA allowed starting to happen a little bit. We saw by the number of players involved that you're getting players back on campus. Take us through where you guys are in trying to restart a conditioning phase for Texas A&M.
Well, what you say, it's all voluntary. I mean, it's all on their choices, which most guys want to do. And some of, and you've had a few kids that want to stay home, which I understand. That's, you know, what we try to say is just this thing is going to let loose and get to mandatory times when we think football's coming up. So do the best you can do in the safest environment you can do it in to be able to get in the best shape of your life. I mean, I don't think there's any way to protect people from everything. No matter if, you know, whether you go to the store, you go to a restaurant, you go wherever, you can come in contact, but you have to just keep the safe measures, keep, you know, wear your mask, keep things as with the 6 foot social distancing and all the things that go on. And so what we're trying to do then is provide, you know, you give them a workout, they go do it on their own, try to, you know, monitor each other. And we try to do it in limited numbers, so there's even space. And like, there's only so many people allowed in a weight room at a time, so many people allowed wherever they go at a time, so you can keep the social distancing rules and what goes on. And then, you know, hope that they work their tails off, because when it comes back, that's the one thing you do worry about. It's not, you know, you got to be safe with the social distancing, but I don't think nothing is foolproof. I don't care where it's at, whether you're in society or here, but the thing about it is we got to monitor the thing here. You have great medical facilities. You have great people that you can constantly check, you know, temperature checks, symptom checks with doctors and things that we think to create as safe environment as you can. But, you know, guys are going to become, and the thing with we're finding out is that there's so many asymptomatic guys that, you know, are around guys. A good thing, the testing that we're able to provide testing for them so they can find that out, and we can quarantine guys until they're, you know, we don't feel they're contagious and the things that go on. But our guys are working hard. I think the guys want to be back. They're looking forward to be back, but they're trying to do it in a safe environment.
For some of the coaches, not having a returning quarterback is going to be part of the conversation of what you miss not having a full spring and not having leadership and things like that develop. You've got Kellen Mond there, your quarterback. So how impactful will it be for what you guys want to do on the offensive side of the ball to know that there's somebody come back who's been there and done it already?
I mean, has done it, as I say, under fire in games and been very successful, tremendous. And he's that way. And I think it's going to have a huge effect. I mean, you think about his play, but I think the play around him and the ability for him to talk to teammates, lead teammates, because a quarterback, when he takes over, you say, okay, he's the leader of your team. Until they can prove themselves, it's hard to really be a leader because you're so worried about, can I do my job? We know Kellen can perform and play great football. So he's allowing himself, and that's allowing us, he can use himself to be a leader to the other guys and the other new position guys that are coming into our offense and the things that go on. But having him is a huge, huge advantage, there's no doubt. And like I say, he's working his tail off and, you know, just a tremendously high character quality young man.
You know, championship football, like I said before, the A&M deal is one of the most unique ones to me because you have Texas and the battle in state and all that stuff, yet you're in the SEC, and it's such a huge, powerful football program. After 3 years there, can you give me the lay of the land of what this job is like? What's the unique challenge, I should say, of this job at College Station with Texas A&M?
I think one thing, the branding of what we have to do, because they stayed in the state of Texas, which is, you know, as good a state as there is in this country for football. And we're trying to get all the players in Texas that we can possibly get. But at the same time, nationally branding it, because I think we're in such a global world now that young men go everywhere. And when you really research Texas A&M, when you get down to it's a top 20 school educationally, got an unbelievable culture and environment here, their facilities and the support you get from your athletic department and your school for athletics. And then you have the largest or one of the two largest alumni groups, former students in the country, and the job market went and with it, you know, being a, have an endowment of $13.5 billion. There is so much here that people didn't realize. And I think the branding of ourselves nationally, along with being in a tremendous state that we can get great players, and then, you know, proving yourself that you can go win in the SEC. And you know, our first year we were second in the West. Last year we were 8-5, had a very tough schedule, but at the time had a young team. But at the same time, you know, we're in a lot of those games. We feel very confident. We've had two good recruiting classes. And, you know, it's a fight for players here, not only with Texas, you know, Oklahoma and all those schools, Baylor and all the in-state schools that go in, Texas and whoever. But now that the other conferences, like I say, it's such a global world, players go everywhere. So you're having the people come to where there's large groups of players. So establishing that, and I think, you know, now that we can start to establish, I think in the future, I think we can have some really good football teams. And you start getting in the hunt, the title hunt each and every year, I think this place has a chance to really explode and be a tremendous program.
And when we connected virtually here right before the break, I said, at some point, you may get back to actually coaching ball. It's been interesting, I'm sure, for the head coaches. And Brian Kelly, we're talking about this a couple of days ago, that everything that's been going on, the coronavirus, now everything that's going on with the protest, it's been so much getting your team and the mentality and the conversations. It's been away from the main part of the job. I'm sure at some point you look forward to getting to the football coaching part of this thing.
No doubt. And I mean, the Zoom calls in which we allow, you know, 8 hours a week with our players is very good. And your assistants do it. And I've been on some. But at the same time, as a head coach, you're having to work on other things because of the different pandemics and the you know, the whole of the movement and the Black Lives Matter and the different things. Because a lot of these kids right now, football, they do it, but it's not always on the forefront of their mind. And I totally understand that. And we're in different times. And like to say, it's a very educational time for me in learning and how to coach people, to work with people, and to get people back to the same page, because, you know, normal is going to come very soon, or what we have to do, and we have to, but you have to be very respectful of all the different things that are going on, and, but, you know, it is fun when we do get to talk ball, and you know, what's funny, when the kids get to doing a lot of it, you see the smile on their face, and you know, they're eager, because they realize, you know, how much they really missed it when they were out.
Yeah, they can have that back with the other stuff, too. They don't have to be mutually exclusive. And that blend is going to be, I think, a real story in college football this season. Hopefully we have a season that keeps moving in that direction. Jimbo, good to catch up. It's been too long. All the best to you down there in College Station.
Great to you, Mike. Thank you very much. You have a great day, buddy.
You too. Jimbo Fisher, head football coach, Texas A&M. Golf is back in the state of Texas. They played in Fort Worth at Colonial yesterday. Paul Azinger was watching a whole bunch of it. We'll check in with Zinger, our golf analyst, when we come back on Lunch Talk Live.
If I'm thinking about winning a golf tournament right now, I've probably lost it. So, yeah, I know what's going on, but when I'm on the golf course, I'm trying to play well. The reason I have a platform is because I'm really good at golf. So I just need to focus on that. And to be honest with you, being on the golf course kind of, you know, it helped me. It's my getaway, I guess. But I didn't really think it'd be like that until I got on the first hole, and it was like I hooked one super far left, and I was like, oh, you know, I was pissed. You know, like it was good. Those juices are awesome.
Harold Varner III, four total members of the PGA Tour who are African-American, and Varner's one of them. He was talking a lot about the Black Lives Matter movement. Paul Azinger, our NBC Sports golf analyst, joins us here. It's a terrific online piece. If you folks didn't catch it, Harold Varner, real honest conversation with Jay Monahan, the PGA Tour commissioner. Harold went out and played a great round yesterday. Zinger, he's backed it up the first eight holes today. He's tied for the lead at 10 under par as we speak during the second round of the Charles Schwab Challenge at Colonial at Fort Worth. It's got to be an incredible purpose to what Harold Varner is doing on the golf course right now, absent the return from golf for 3 months. Can you only imagine the things he's kind of going through as he plays out there right now.
Yeah, I imagine there's a big spotlight on Harold Varner, Mike, and you know, that's pretty obvious. But boy, he came out and really got after it yesterday. And it's interesting. It was funny to me after he had his very first tee shot, he got pissed. And I thought, oh, that's good. This guy, I'm sure, worked really hard in a difficult time, troubled times as well. And, you know, these guys, a lot of these guys came out here ready to, you know, bust out of the gates, to sprint out of the gates. You know, you heard Rory McIlroy say that this season is going to be more of a sprint. And guys like Harold Varner, they know this is an opportunity for them to come out of here and play good. He's got, obviously, more spotlight on him for obvious reasons. But that golf ball, you know, once you get pro by your name and you're on the PGA Tour, there's no discriminating out here. He knows that, but he's going to let his clubs do the talking, I think. And Harold Varner, I know him. He's a good kid. He's smart, and he can really play. He's got a lot of guts. And if you get a chip on his shoulder, watch out for Harold Varner.
We'll continue to watch how those guys do over the weekend. Paul, I want to ask you, not specifically, you don't know what Varner's going through necessarily, but I know you've played golf with a purpose sometimes when you've gone out on the golf course, think of coming back after dealing with cancer very publicly. There are times that guys go out and play with an inner feeling that's just a little bit different. For those of us who've never been in that point in our careers, what is that like when you're out there doing it with that kind of feeling inside?
Professional golf is just such an individual game. I mean, you have to get lost and alone and kind of really selfish about your time. And I think that's the greatest commodity for anybody, really. But for professional players, they're very selfish with their time, and they have to be if they're going to be great. And but you know, when you prepare to get ready for an event like this, some guys can bust out of the gate, Mike, and be ready to rock. And other guys, it takes them a little longer. They have to get some reps or tournaments or some rounds under their belt. But a lot of these guys, they knew they were coming in, a tremendous sacrifice for the European Tour players and all those guys in the international game, because they had to quarantine for a couple weeks when they got here. So it's taken them virtually a month to be able to, it's more time for them than it is for the American players. I think it's a weird time in this country for us to have all been quarantined like this, and now we're busting out. It was a race, it felt like, for sports to see who could be first, and golf is right there out of the blocks with NASCAR, and these other sports are trying to figure out how to do this, Mike. But as a player, as an individual player, you know, this is when you put pro by your name, this is an individual game, and you know what you're doing. And I guarantee you, they were preparing mentally, playing the course in their head. And, you know, some guys are fast starters, and they know right now it's time that you got great chance here to make a move. Brendan Todd's sitting in great shape with this big delay. There's a lot of players in great shape. Watch out for Rory McIlroy, and Justin Rose sent a signal too.
Yeah, Rory's 6-under for his round today, a couple of shots off the lead. I want to ask you about Jordan Spieth, because, Paul, he's always played well at Colonial, and he's tied with Harold Varner for the lead as we are speaking, you know, about 12:30 Eastern time, so in the middle of their second round. When you go back to a place where you've had success, oftentimes you find that feeling again, just whether it's your eye or the comfort, whatever it is. And, boy, if anybody needed a break and something to come out right away and be in a good position, Jordan Spieth is that guy. For me, he's one of the more interesting guys to watch how the weekend plays out for him. How about for you?
Same, Mike. I think he's a great curiosity for all of us to see how Jordan Spieth will come out of here in this time. And I know he's one that does a lot of practice. He's one of those guys that looks under every rock, doesn't he? He's trying to figure out a way to be the hammer instead of the nail. And I hope he can do it. I mean, golf's a fickle game. It plays with your emotions, and it's a physical game too, though. And Jordan's had a couple things to overcome. I think some of his trouble became mental, this desire for perfection. I mean, he wears his heart on his sleeve as well. You can tell he's a perfectionist in the way he thinks and the way he reacts. I hope the tour can get him mic'd up, because that's the guy I want to hear talking.
We hear him so often. He is so verbal with his caddy, Michael Greller. The mics in the fairway often pick him up, but that's right. To hear full conversation from him would be really neat. So our friend Nick Faldo put up on Twitter, he was in a golf cart with Bryson DeChambeau back in Florida. I think I'm not sure where they shot it, but in any case, Bryson has gone from a medium to a large to an extra large in shirt size. He looks so drastically different than he did a year and a half ago. And his average driving distance yesterday was 3.25. I mean, he is absolutely crushing the ball. Have you seen a good player make that significant a physical change in a 9-month period of time to almost change what their golf game's about?
Well, our good friend Nick Faldo did it, but not to this extent. I mean, he's trying to break all the molds and all the taboos, really, with the sport. The idea that you would get bigger and get better. I remember Keith Clearwater did it and came back, and he was never quite the same. Johnny Miller famously was never quite the same. And but Bryson is backing it up. I just can't believe the size of the man and the fact that what he's doing is actually contributing to greater distance and greater speed. A lot of times when you see a guy increase in size like that, Mike, they lose their flexibility and elasticity. He's got to be careful that because longevity is a big part of golf, and you want to be here a long, long time. And he's playing golf and getting his body ready like he's in here for the short haul. But, you know, he could have a 30-year career. I'm not sure if he's going to shorten his career or not by getting strong and big like this. But, you know, if he breaks the mold, he'd be the right guy to do it. Everything he does is his own way. There's no doubt about that.
And it's researched and programmed, and he has the data to back it, and he'll challenge you on it if you disagree with him. Lastly, let's leave with Sung Kang, who had a hole-in-one yesterday. I guess, Zinger, there's no bad time for a hole-in-one, but you might as well do it when there's really nobody in the clubhouse. There's no press room you have to buy a tub of beers for. I mean, this is a timely ace in a lot of ways from Sung Kang.
Yeah, it didn't cost him anything, and he's going to make a little money, and he got ghosted by the gallery. No gallery. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, Mike, I don't think it's going to be hard on these guys to adjust to no fans. I think maybe the big adjustment will be when the fans come back and how they're going to react with the fans and how that whole social distancing works out. But no fans for these guys, I think, is something that they're embracing, and they love it.
Yeah, the Thursday, great. Friday, the you're off average, plate.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I think the scoring average is going to be terrific. These guys are going to shoot some wonderful scores. They've got no pressure, no cat calls, no heckling from the crowd, no reminders that you're leading the tournament when you might be the kind of player that doesn't want to know that sort of thing. So I think a lot of the pressure comes off these players. It may be worth a couple of 3 putts a day. You never know.
Yeah, the Thursday, Friday, you'll play sometimes early without a lot of fans. I'll be interested to see how it impacts with no fans around when it's pressure time, back nine on Sunday. And it looked like there'll be a lot of good names up there, so this could be fun stuff. All right, Zinger, thanks. Keep fishing. Did you catch any fish this morning, by the way?
Oh, I killed them this morning, but I can't tell you where. Right here.
Goodbye. Get out of here. Paul Azinger, one more time. America's fisherman. He is the outdoor king. Thanks, Zinger. We'll talk to you soon, buddy. When we come back, Martin Truex, who won in NASCAR. I was going to say last week, but it was Wednesday. Martin Truex Jr., Cup champion, will join the show. Same true with Nick Luck, our horse racing analyst. Stay with us. Man, Sunday night, Wednesday, NASCAR Cup races have come fast and furious, and Martin Truex dominated that last stage of the race on Wednesday at Martinsville, and he ends up with his first victory of the season. This is the Cup Series champ from 2017. Runner-up, or I should say right there in the championship, 4 times as well in 2017, 18, and 19. Martin moved outside to try to join us here with Wi-Fi issues. He's got the dog outside. We have Martin. set to join us here on Lunch Talk Live. He's back inside now. All right, there he is. I thought we were going to get to meet your dog, Charlie. And Martin, we lost him. We had him for a brief second, and we lost him. In any case, we'll reconnect with Martin. It was an interesting race to watch last Wednesday night. He's back. All right, you're back now. I love this. We're having some fun here. Look, we're going to end the show on a good note. We'll end the show with a technical nightmare. How you doing? You doing all right?
I'm doing all right. Apparently better than my Wi-Fi.
That's okay. I thought we were going to meet Charlie the dog for a second.
Well, yeah, she was downstairs and we tried to say hello, but I was losing you. So I was trying to get somewhere where I could get some service. Technology, you know?
It's all good now. Hey, this is the way the world has been, and this is the way the last month or so has been. What has it been like to Cup race Sunday and then Wednesday, and it's been hot and guys have been, you know, dehydrating after races and all that? How tough has it been physically on you?
It's definitely been a little bit tougher than I think, you know, most people are used to. But, you know, for me, I've been good. I've felt, you know, really good after these races. And I think it helps when your cars run good and you're fast. It keeps your mind off it. But, yeah, just trying to, you know, really just trying to stay prepared for racing, you know, twice a week by taking care of myself, eating healthy and drinking, I mean, lots of water. That's basically the key. So, you know, I think we get, you know, after years of doing this, you kind of figure out, you know, little things to do here and there that help you. And the biggest key for me is just drinking lots of water all week.
That was your 27th Cup win. So you kind of know the drill of what you're supposed to do. I was laughing as I kept watching you get out of the car on Wednesday night. You're like, do I wave? Do I really stand up here on the door? And what do I do? You were looking around like, somebody give me a clue here. How weird did it feel?
Yeah, it definitely, you know, it felt weird for sure. I mean, just not feeling the energy of the fans, you know, especially at a place like Martinsville where you're celebrating right on the front straightaway of the racetrack. Yeah, I mean, you're, you know, 40 feet from the grandstands, 30 feet from the grandstands. So you feel that energy and you hear everybody yelling and you feed off of that. So it was definitely strange to not have that. And then, you know, we usually do victory lane and photos and all that with the team on the front straightaway there as well. And so you know, after my interviews and things, like, I didn't even know where to go. I was like, where do I go? What do I do with my car? You know, so it was a little bit strange to go do that and take the victory lane picture with the clock by myself and the mask. And, you know, it's tough for everybody right now, but I really would have loved to have been able to celebrate with my team. That's probably one of my favorite parts about winning these races is just to celebrate with the team and, you know, thank them. But hey, you know, it is what it is.
Sure. You saw the grandfather clock. That's what you get for winning at Martinsville. You've got a couple of those now. It's a pretty unique and sweet little token for your victory, actually a big token. But it was an interesting evening because Martinsville hadn't done a night race with lights for the Cup Series. And this is a track, the oldest track that NASCAR keeps going back to. So that was different. And then obviously everything with Bubba Wallace and the paint scheme on the 43 car. It was a unique night. How much of that did you guys feel and appreciate as it was going on as you left the track?
Yeah, I think, you know, you think about all those things, you know, leading up into the race and then, you know, on the grid pre-race, and you feel, you kind of understand what's going on around you and you know, how big of a moment it really is, what kind of, you know, impact it's going to have on the sport going forward and things like that. So once you get in the car, you're in the zone, you're you know, focused on what you're doing in the race car, and you kind of forget about all those things and you just focus on doing your job. But definitely a big night. I think you're looking at TV ratings and things like that. It was quite an effort, quite a show. So hopefully everybody enjoyed it.
They stopped the cars Sunday for a message from NASCAR's leadership about NASCAR opening up its arms and trying to be part of the conversation. The paint scheme we talked about, the Confederate flag ban, all that kind of stuff. You're a guy who grew up in New Jersey, did not grow up necessarily in the South, but obviously living through all of this, you have a keen awareness of what's going on. What's your sense of this opportunity for your sport right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's a big opportunity. I think NASCAR's taken all the right steps to make sure everybody, you know, that comes to our races, feels, you know, comfortable in what they're, you know, where they're at, who's around them, how people act. I mean, it's, you know, I definitely stand with NASCAR, their decisions and what they've done. And I know it's You know, it's a tough topic for a lot of people, but, you know, I think for the sport going forward, for our future of our fans, I think it's the right way to go.
Thanks for the adjustments to getting behind the camera instead of behind the wheel here to make this segment happen. Big Philadelphia sports fan growing up about an hour outside of Philly. So hopefully we'll get your Phillies back on the field and the Flyers in the playoffs and the Sixers going. So you'll have other stuff to do in addition to driving every couple of days. Good luck in Miami this weekend.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. That'd be great. I appreciate it. Take care.
We appreciate you. Martin Truex Jr., the Cup champion, series champ from 2017, runner-up the last couple of years. Let's bring in our colleague, Nick Luck, who we go from four-wheel to four-leg racing. Royal Ascot comes your way on NBCSN. It'll be every morning, Tuesday through Friday, 8:30 a.m. till noon. And then we'll have a show Saturday, Belmont Day on NBC, 9 to noon with Ascot. Our Belmont coverage will follow at 2:45 Eastern after the Premier League. And Nick Luck joins us now. Nick, this has been a very unique time in the sport. It's been a unique time on both sides of the pond. Can you just give us what the coronavirus COVID-19 situation is in England as you've been over there for this stretch?
Well, in a similar position to the United States, it's hit the whole country hard. It's hit the bigger cities hardest. But we are now, Mike, easing our way very gingerly out of lockdown. What has that meant for sport? Well, most sports have to wait. Premier League next week. Horse racing has stolen a little bit of a march. We've been horse racing again since June the 1st. Had to make a convincing and cogent case to government here that it shouldn't be treated like other sports, that social distancing was possible, that we were able to run a race day with all those biosecurity measures that are normally just reserved for the horses, but applying some of that veterinary science that we're used to when keeping horses apart for biosecurity reasons to humans. And actually, we can do that pretty effectively. So we've been going again horse racing-wise here since June the 1st, and it's to our great fortune, really, that Royal Ascot comes fairly quickly. Martin was talking there about using any opportunity you can find during this pandemic, and I think there's a big opportunity to reach a wider audience for this sport, as has been seen with you in the States.
Nick, one of the great joys of my career has been being able to spend a lot of time in the summer covering sports in the UK, the British Open, the Open Championship golf for the last quarter century, time at Wimbledon. You have the Formula One, the Grand Prix at Silverstone. Sports in the summer in the United Kingdom is so rich and has such history. Can you let our viewers know where Royal Ascot fits in that list of traditional summer sporting events in Great Britain?
Well, it always used to be known as the season, the Great British Sporting Summer Season, and Royal Ascot was at the very heart of it, and to a sense still is. What I love about Royal Ascot is that it marries up the best of the ancient, the tradition of Her Majesty the Queen leading friends and family in landaus, carriages, up the famous Royal Mile that's been going since 1711, with modern, the very best of sport, the very best of horse racing, and sport that Ascot have endeavoured to make better and better. The event has a contemporary feel to it now, whilst retaining all that tradition. And of course, Mike, this year, we've got an occasion with no occasion. So what do you recoil from that? Or do you try and go as big as you can? And I'm really pleased that Ascot have embraced this concept of Royal Ascot at home. They've sent out these little badges to everybody, these name badges to pretend that they're in the royal enclosure. These are the badges that you would normally have if you were admitted to the royal enclosure. They've asked people to dress up. So in the spirit of that, I'll be dressing up at home for the first 4 days before I join you on NBC, minus the top hat, on Saturday the 20th. So as I say, these are strange times, but we can still make the best of sport and everybody can still get involved. And that's where television has such a crucial role to play.
Yeah, it's Royal Ascot without the royals for the first time in some time. The Queen loves her horse racing. She is a very, very large fan of the game. As we wrap up here, Nick, there are going to be some Breeders' Cup Challenge races. Win and you get in to the Breeders' Cup in November. I know you and Brittany Ertin have been keeping the Breeders' Cup theme going online with some cocktails and some conversation every Thursday night during this pandemic. It's really exciting to see the Breeders' Cup include some of the best from races around the world coming this year to Keeneland in the first weekend in November.
That's right. First weekend in November in Keeneland. It's quite a late Breeders' Cup this year, and we were initially quite worried about that because Kentucky, second weekend in November, but this may be a blessing now, because the later it is, the more chance there is perhaps of some crowd involvement, and we've got a better build up to it with this abridged season of horse racing, both in the US and the UK. But you're right, Breeders' Cup Challenge races. So winning gives you an automatic berth to the Breeders' Cup Divisional Championship in November. Four of those at Ascot, and we'll be televising those as part of this sports triple header on NBC next Saturday.
Yeah, that's next Saturday. So Ascot in the morning, followed by Premier League, and then we'll have the Belmont Stakes. Matter of fact, we're going to look back. Speaking of the Belmont, we showed you American Pharoah winning the Triple Crown in 2015. Pharoah winning the Breeders' Cup Classic to complete the Grand Slam in 2015. We'll show you that this weekend as we get set for live racing next week. Starting on Tuesday, Nick will be covering all the Royal Ascot races and lack of pageantry, but Nick will bring the pageantry in his own presentation. Thanks, pal. Stay safe. We'll see you on TV next week.
Not a bit, Mike. Always good to chat. We'll connect next week.
Same here, for sure. Nick Luck joining us there. A reminder, horse racing is back. Bet the races from home. Visit americasbestracing.net. You'd think I'd have that memorized after 3 days, but I don't. We'll have a final thought on doing this show for the last 10 weeks as we continue. One more segment on Lunch Talk Live right after this.
Come on.
Welcome to the new world, right? Matt Casey, our producer, who, by the way, did not only a tremendous job of lining up guests, producing the show from a kitchen, becoming a dad for the first time, and moving all during the 10 weeks of pulling this show together. So thanks to Matt and the entire Lunch Bunch, too. Matt, Evan, Jenny, Kristen working, not just directing, but also punching the buttons too. Adam, Brett, the names go on and on. There are a whole bunch of the people. I'm glad we did that. That's awesome. Look at that whole group that has done a tremendous job. Dan Steer there with the Michigan mug. Thank you all for doing an unbelievable job. Matt's little baby Michael in there. Way to go. Congratulations. Thank you all for making these 10 weeks so much fun. And we all have a mug to show for it. The show really hit it. We got a mug. I think we made four of them. Tom Popple, Chris Connolly, Tim Cannery, Scott Lozé, Bob Stack, Siri Cam, Monty Croach, just some of the technical folks who by name you may not know, but they made this impossible multi-city effort possible. This has been fun. We started the show in large part just to fill the void, and because, as you saw, so many people have been at home. Martin Truex in his basement, Jimbo Fisher in his house, Joe Judge, coach of the Giants, going out to the back deck because his kids are doing school inside. As sports come back, we're going to let us do what we normally do, and that's cover sports. But this has been fun, and thank you for sharing the time with us. Some great conversation. Over the next month, essentially for the balance of June, all but a couple of days, there'll be live sports on NBCSN. We've got the Premier League coming back. We mentioned Royal Ascot. We've got golf on Golf Channel. The Belmont Stakes Saturday on NBC. Looking forward to NASCAR and IndyCar being together 4th of July weekend for a doubleheader. The sports conversation will continue in this time window as well, as my pal Rich Eisen will be here. Rich's show is next. Among the guests, Steven Jackson and me. He ran out of guestable. Thanks for enjoying lunch with us. We'll see you soon.